his own foot in plaster at the time. So when I saw the blood gushing out of my foot, I hopped over to the sala and knocked on the door, and Lumpur came out on his crutch with his foot in plaster, and being very practical and looking at the blood pouring out over the concrete, he said, "I think we better get that foot in the air." So I thought, oh, good idea, before all the blood runs out. So I can't say I actually definitely owe my life to him, but he was certainly very helpful, and he's been a wonderful Dhamma companion for many years. We were together founding and developing Abhayagiri Monastery in California for 14 years together. I went there to start the monastery in 1996, and Lumpur was with me from the beginning of 1997 until I departed to come here to Amaravati in the summer of 2010. So it was a kind of forced separation. It was a divorce, not by our own design. But so we were a bit sad in some ways to part company, but I'm very happy to have him here. And we decided to try and each year come to visit each other's monasteries to help build a bridge across the Atlantic and over the American continent, so we would bring Abhayagiri Monastery and Amaravati Monastery closer together. He's been a monk now for 40 years. He just finished his 40th pansar, so Sadhu Anumodana for that. He was originally took Upasampada, became a bhikkhu at Wat Plang Vipassana in Bangkok, but was training with Lumpur Cha from very soon after becoming a bhikkhu, and has been one of the most dedicated and committed, helpful monks and highly respected monks within the Wat Bopong community. So very delighted to have him here today. He'll be speaking in English. So all the Thai people who've been hoping he's going to give a Dhamma talk in Thai, you know, another time. So we're very happy to have him here today, and so I'd like to invite him to come and there'll be a Brahmachaloka, I think, request, and then he'll be ascending the Dhamma seat.
Brahmachaloka Tipati Sampati Kat An Chari An Tiwarang Ayajata Santi Thasatta Parachakachatika Tese Tuthamang Anukam Bimang Pachang Kao Aratana Nimun Joa.
Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhasa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhasa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sama sambuddhasa. Buddhaṃ dhammaṃ saṅghaṃ namassāmi. Okay, so I'm very glad to have the opportunity to join you all for Katina. As Ajahn Amaro mentioned, we are trying to support each other from a distance. So that it was 2 years ago now that I came over here for Katina. Then last year, Ajahn Amaro came to Abhayagiri for Arkatina, so I'm here, and we're already making plans how to get Ajahn Amaro over to Abhayagiri for next year. So we'll try to keep that connection going, because it's I think these are important things to be doing for finding ways for creating a kind of connection and community and harmony, which is, of course, what Katina is all about. The Katina ceremony, I heard one time as a very beautiful translation and very apt, is a celebration of harmony. That's what the Katina really is for. And both in terms of historically of the Buddha establishing the Katina ceremony, the different protocols, the different ways that it is done and accomplished, it highlights and facilitates the coming together of the monastic community and the lay community and the mutual support and encouragement for each other. So that it is something to celebrate and to delight in, this quality of harmony. And in terms of harmony, it doesn't happen on its own, or just because of wishful thinking. Everybody wants to live harmoniously. Everybody wants to live peacefully. Everybody wants to be, good in also many ways. And those are really nice ideas and ideals. But how do we accomplish that? And I think that's where the Buddha's teachings are so practical. The Buddha really laid out practical ways of developing these wholesome qualities, so that just as today we have the opportunity to come together, and that's where ceremony and ritual has a function. On one level, you could say, "Oh, it's just just another ceremony." Or it's just a ritual, just do this, do that. And but if it's done in the right spirit, and certainly as we saw today and as we see when we do come together here at Amaravati, that coming together facilitates a happiness and a well-being. Because when we come together with that intention of virtue, an intention of generosity, and an intention of reflecting on our circumstances, on our commitment, then it brings about an inner well-being, an inner harmony, and an external harmony, external well-being, and that's exceedingly nourishing. Really, as human beings, we nourish ourselves. We find nutriment in physical food, and we had lots of it today, we also need to be nourishing ourselves with the with Dhamma, with the teachings, and with applying those teachings, living the teachings, putting them into practice in our daily lives, so that when we take on something quite on a certain level. It's quite fundamental, the quality of generosity, of sharing, of giving. That's a a very fundamental human quality. But when we take it on, it has results, and it creates bonds of friendship, bonds of warmth, bonds of affection. In that sense of when we give, we share. We see that we're engaged in helping and being of service to each other, and that that creates a kind of a deeper bond of harmony and well-being between us. There's a lovely story of Benjamin Franklin, one of the founding fathers of America, and not known for his Buddhist practice, of course, but I think he understood some of the principles, or human principles, really. There's a story when he was part of the legislature and governor, I think, of Pennsylvania. Then there was a fellow legislator who they were always at odds with each other, and this other legislator was always finding something to criticize or undermine Benjamin Franklin in some way. And Benjamin Franklin, being an astute observer of human nature, he kind of thought it through and was asking around of what that particular person, what that particular person's kind of likes were and temperament. And that particular person had he loved collecting books, and he loved collecting rare books. And those are in the days of, you know, this is mid-1700s, so books were still a fairly rare commodity, and this legislator was a collector of rare books. So Benjamin Franklin went and approached this other legislator and asked him if he had a particular rare book that he was interested in. And the person sort of said yes. And so then Franklin asked if he could borrow it. And so then he borrowed it. And he gave it to him, so he borrowed it, took it home, and kept it for a period of time. I'm not even sure if he read it. But then he brought it back and thanked him and profusely for giving him the opportunity to have had that book. And that was a changing point in their relationship. Because it was always, the relationship was one of contention before. But now it's that something shared, something given, something received in gratitude, it changed the relationship. And so that former relationship of contention and conflict dissolved, and it provided a basis for harmony. So that the effects of giving and sharing, and of course of gratitude, those have a tremendous power. It's easy to overlook it, to not notice how it affects us. But just by, as Ajahn Lumpa Sopon mentioned, all through the day today, what was the demeanor and the way that people related to each other? I don't know about anybody else, but certainly what I saw was a lot of happy faces. And they'll probably go home and be happy. They probably won't just leave it here and then go home and find something to be miserable about. That happiness goes with them. So these are very natural human qualities, and it's something that we all can be doing. We can all be engaging in some kind of generosity, some kind of giving, and we can delight in that. And then when we share, it does form a basis of harmony. I think all through human culture and human societies, but particularly I think nowadays, and whether it's a Western European culture or whether it's an Asian culture, there's a lot of value placed on wealth, on getting ahead, on having status, and gaining something that is valued in the world. And I can always remember Ajahn Chah just sitting in one time and saying, I don't see any rich people nowadays. And said, or at least I don't meet them. And he said, all I see is people who don't have enough. especially somebody like Ajahn Chah making that observation, because that sense of a sense of wealth, a sense of well-being that we search for in our lives, it doesn't really come from external things. It doesn't come from possessions or the some kind of status in the world. It really comes from internal qualities. And the internal qualities that come from the ways of developing harmony, those are exceedingly important. You know, another fundamental quality that is a foundation for harmony is precepts, five precepts. And not so much as rules that you have to live by, but principles that create a result. So that when we live by the principles of non-harming, of honesty and integrity of our actions and body and speech, then what we're creating is a fundamental trust. And because when somebody lives within the precepts, has those precepts as a foundation, there's a feeling of trust that one has towards that person. It's quite natural. And you feel that this person is going to be honest with me, this person is not going to take advantage of me, this person is not going to harm me. So that there's a fundamental trust that is laid down. And that's, again, when there's a fundamental trust between us as human beings, then there's harmony. It's not, as they say in the States, it ain't rocket science. This is really easy. This is something to, you know, but it's these things we tend to overlook. There's a, like one of the things that I think we tend to do, you know, one a problem that we have as human beings is that we, not that we don't see truth or see Dhamma or see the benefit in the Dhamma, but we all, what happens is we tend to look past it. It's like we're looking a bit too far ahead rather than seeing what's really tangible and beneficial with us right now. It's like the image that Ajahn Chah gives of said in Thailand, when you the old way of picking a ripe mango, right, one is just to let it ripen on the tree first, and then you have a long bamboo pole with a little rattan basket at the end, and you go up and you just hook the mango, and then you bring it down, and then it's not bruised, and you can get it quite comfortably. But in order to get it, the pole actually has to be the right length. If it's too short, it doesn't reach. If it's too long, then it goes past it and you can't get it. So it's Ajahn Chah used that as an image of how we apply our wisdom and discernment and our intelligence. He said sometimes we don't use our intelligence enough, and sometimes we're a bit too clever for our own good. And we go past the Dhamma. We're not. So that sense of just right is really important. The quality of just right, just having the length of the bamboo pole is just right. In the same way, our application of our intelligence, our discernment, our wisdom has to be just right. And just right means, particularly in terms of Dhamma, you don't have to figure absolutely everything out. All you need to do is to not suffer. And that's because the Buddha says over and over and over again, it says, all I teach is just suffering and the end of suffering. And it's easy to sort of, well, there must be something more than that. But if you get that point and you pay attention to it, you keep investigating, you keep applying it, then you, really everything unfolds from that. So getting that point of just right is really important. And in a certain sense, the whole path of practice is also an application of just right. When we think of the Noble Eightfold Path of the Lord Buddha's, of say samma ditti, right view, samma sankappa, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. We think of that word right, and then I think we tend to, you know, try to sometimes pin it down a bit too narrowly, or think we've got to get something more over. But that word samma is a word that is one that can be, you know, interpreted when we think of right. It's that sense of just right. And also, in tune, so right in tune with each other, so that the different factors of the path, the different factors of our body, speech, and mind, the different factors of our practice, of virtue, of meditation, of wisdom, that they're right in tune, that they're just right with each other, that they're tuning in with each other and working together so that they decrease suffering, bring suffering to an end. So that's the sense of... So they, and then the path needs to be in harmony. So that when we're talking about harmony, it's not... when we pay attention to external harmony, we start to get... We develop a skill in it, and it's all... I mean, it makes one happy, it makes one... has a sense of well-being. One of the natural results of well-being and the mind being suffused with wholesome dhammas is that the mind becomes more peaceful and settled. When the mind's more peaceful and settled, it sees things more clearly, and the practice develops so that the internal harmony starts to function. It starts to work. The harmony of the factors of training that allow us to free the heart from suffering. These are the things that happen when we develop these fundamental teachings and lay our foundations really well. So that I think today this is the second Dhamma talk. I think it's good enough. I think it's maybe even just right. So offer that for your reflection.